on today's episode of the Law of Tech podcast.
We want to change the culture and basically say, if it doesn't work on day zero, it's not going to work on day one. And so many people have bad stories with AI, but they're not really changing how they're evaluating AI. They're just kind of closing up to AI. But the reason that it didn't work is because the AI doesn't work. And the only thing you do when you buy a tool is you'll just receive contracts you've never seen before from vendors and counterparties, and you'll upload them to the tool and expect results. And if when you're evaluating a tool, if you're not just uploading contracts it's never seen before and seeing its results in seconds, then you're gonna end up holding the bag because you weren't testing for the thing you're actually doing with it.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Law of Tech podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking a little bit more about how to build a legal tech startup in law school. And for this, I am joined by Mei Mei on WoodyWay. Mei Mei is part of the founding team of the AI company Evisort, which he helped build out of the Harvard Innovation Lab. He found and chaired Harvard's Legal Technology Symposium, which brings leaders in legal technology to Harvard's campus annually. And at Evisort, Mei Mei works as the Executive Vice President, Legal and Business Intelligence, where he works with clients to make sure that Evisort's AI solutions solve their core business problems. Mei Mei, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and super excited to chat.
Now, to really kick off this episode, can you maybe tell us a little bit more about your educational and professional background?
Yeah, most definitely. So, you know, as you said, I went to Harvard Law School, and while I was at Harvard Law School studying for my JD, you know, worked with other law students from Harvard as well as data scientists from MIT to build the company Evisort. And so actually did my 1L, which is my first year of law school, and the first semester is when I met, who would be the CEO and COO of Evisort. At the time, there were 2L, second year law students at Harvard. And basically, you know, during that time, we had just set up a space at the Harvard Innovation Lab, where we could basically begin to build out a company. At the time, it was 5 folks, you know, 4 folks from the Harvard Law School and then data scientists from MIT. And what we were basically doing was tagging data, just, you know, getting publicly available contracts. The lawyers would track the information, and what the AI team and the data science team would do is they would take the data that we were tagging and build AI models out of it to automatically track that information in contracts. And we spent a couple years doing that. And then at the end of that, we had these really robust AI models. We didn't actually have a platform at the time because we had data scientists, not computer scientists, and we had to kind of learn that those are different things. And so, you know, at that point, we began to get a computer scientist build a product around these AI models. And you know, by the time my CEO and COO graduated, I think we'd only raised about, you know, probably, you know, $10 or so million, and they kind of forewent the bar and instead went to Silicon Valley and just opened up an office there. And you know, now we've got about 130 people in the U.S. and Canada. You know, we just closed our Series B, led by General Atlantic and Microsoft. In March of this year, and you know, we're working with companies like Microsoft, Bank of New York, Mellon, Netflix, and kind of companies all around. And so that's kind of been our story. And so it's a really good question in that because I started working, you know, with Evisort during my first semester of law school, a lot of my legal education was kind of the education of how to build a company and train algorithms. And I probably spent more time at the Harvard Innovation Lab, which is physically at the Harvard Business School, you know, probably about as much time there as I did at physically kind of at the law school. So.
So to what extent does Harvard Law School really offer the opportunity for their law students to work in these non-traditional environments or gain experience in these non-traditional environments?
I would say that there's opportunity kind of galore, you know, to dive into these. to dive into these kind of things, just because even without the law school even having to do anything, the fact that there is a Harvard Innovation Lab there, and since the Harvard Innovation Lab allows any Harvard student from any school to go and set up a company and then to have office space when even folks who don't attend Harvard, like data scientists or computer scientists from other schools, can still come in. I'd say, like, even without them, you know, putting in extra effort to support these kind of entrepreneurial innovative exploits, it's just such fertile ground, you know, that by going there, you can leverage those resources, right? And I would say, I mean, for that symposium, we founded that. Like, I was the, you know, me and Riley, we were the co-founders of it. So there had never been a Harvard Legal Technology Symposium before we went and did the first one. But let me tell you something. And this is, of course, back in the days when people came to things in person, right? But we had a lot of high-level people come. Everyone we basically asked to come said yes. And all of them, you could see the surprise on their face when we would say in the beginning of the panel that this is the first ever symposium. Because it's just something they assumed when they heard it, that it had been going on for 30 years.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so, and that's something that I think, well, you know, also, and we did this kind of founding Eversort too, just, you know, creating that idea of creating something from nothing, right? And having it be established in a force when it was kind of, you know, the thing I think about is I saw us go from kind of five folks around a table with a whiteboard, you know, while we're all students, to now kind of, you know, 130 people in the US and Canada and raising 50 million and working with global companies. And just, you know, you can't really unsee that, right? And so I do think it's very fertile ground for being able to kind of take the reins and kind of push for more non-traditional things, especially because, you know, a lot of law school is spent kind of getting grades that enable you to get good law firm options. But, you know, at some schools where, you know, it's easier to get those law firm options, you can kind of explore other things without kind of foregoing that opportunity completely. But one thing I would say, especially just while we're on the topic of Harvard, is, you know, we have been in communication a lot, even while we were students, you know, with lots of leadership, including the dean of Harvard Law. And actually, you know, me and our CEO, Jerry, will actually be kind of coming back on campus this year and teaching a reading group, which will actually be kind of a credit course in the spring with about 12 credit hours. We'll be kind of meeting with students and talking about kind of teaching a course, even though we were just, you know, students recently in law school, but kind of teaching a course on how to create your own company and kind of replicate what we did as law students, right? And so there definitely has been that interest in kind of leaning in from the school administration. And then hopefully, you know, I could talk for days about this. I've actually kind of published a couple pieces on it, but like the whole, especially as a recent student who just saw it, and I didn't take the bar, right? I kind of took a really kind of different route. But I think there's a lot to talk about when it comes to legal education reform there. So
that's really amazing. I don't know how much you can tell about the course that you have in mind, but what are some of the topics that you're thinking of?
I can't tell too much, but I would just say that it's really about, I would even take a broader level, and let me tell you what I think needs to be done, which is that, and I mean, I can tell it to you from a Harvard perspective, but, you know, that a lot of the approach when it comes to looking at law and technology and law and innovation, law and entrepreneurship, you know, is either programs that teach students how to work with entrepreneurs, right, and how to support them and kind of clinical, you know, projects where working with an entrepreneur and kind of providing legal advice. And then when it comes to law and technology, it's usually what's studied is the effect of a law on technology, right? Like, how's GDPR changing things? How's, you know, regulations around facial recognition affecting things, right? And I think it should be flipped, in which there's at least an element or at least a space where you can look at the discussion of how lawyers can be better entrepreneurs themselves, not just, you know, support entrepreneurs, right? And that's the same with business, right? Be better business people, not just support business people. And then also the effect of technology on law, because the practice of law is changing in itself based off technology, and people aren't really talking about that in law schools. And I think that's kind of a shame.
Super interesting, and actually also perfect in line with the topic that I was thinking about for today to talk a little bit more about. Because, well, maybe more broadly, first of all, before we actually start talking about some practical guidance on starting up a legal tech startup as a law student, first of all, looking at the, I guess, the landscape, the legal tech landscape a little bit more. So what types of startups can generally be distinguished with regards to legal tech?
You know, it's really interesting. It's a difficult question. I mean, it's not that difficult of a question, right? There's kind of the idea of, like, you know, e-discovery ones, you know, then there's the, well, one, the whole litigation versus, you know, corporate, right? And so on the left-hand side, it'd be kind of e-discovery or kind of, you know, ones that help you research cases, right? And on the right-hand side, you know, for more the corporate, it'd be, you know, e-signature, contract analytics, and kind of CLM. Now, the reason in the beginning I was like, hey, it's an interesting question is, you know, there's at least a level of debate or question or conversation on kind of what legal tech is and does legal tech exist or, you know, how is it just legal tech? You know, isn't this just technology? Like, is it contract technology and contracts affect the whole business? Or is it like a technology just for legal, right? And I think more and more things are looking towards kind of the former than the latter, right? And so I think it's an interesting question from that perspective. And I think that's kind of a unique thing we maybe had a little bit as students, because not many people, even though more and more, I think everyone's beginning to talk about, hey, you know, end-to-end CLM with AI, you know, and like, you know, data, contract data is important for kind of all different business units, right? I think that's kind of more and more becoming kind of, you know, the accepted thinking. But I'd say back in like 2016, when we were looking at this, we acknowledged pretty deeply that we were not yet lawyers. And so we just spent kind of hundreds of hours talking to lawyers and like hearing what technologies they were using and kind of what kind of they were kind of missing and kind of things from that perspective. And I think we kind of also saw, just having not, you know, I think there's really a law firm focus when we think about law and contracts, and that, you know, we have a bias towards law firms where law makes money, you know, like legal review is lucrative, you know, and all those things. When in reality, when you move to the corporate setting, it's very much not that sense, right? It's a cost center. You know, there's not going to be resources for it, right? And kind of thinking from that perspective. And I felt like we were never really kind of spent years in law firms, kind of, you know, kind of thinking of things from that perspective. So we kind of very early on were like, oh, if we're going to work with companies, you know, it's got to be more than just legal, you know, and like this is contract. And almost the idea that, you know, contracts are almost the least important to legal, right? Because it's the other business units who are using it to drive their business, right? You know, like even marketing needs to know if they can put people's logos on the website or not, right? And so why do they have to ask legal? Why can't that information be democratized enough that they can just figure out, hey, logos can be here, here, and here, right? You know, legal is almost like you need legal to get to the data, almost as a gatekeeper to the data inside the contract, right? But if you could extract the data directly from the contract, then you can get it more directly to business units, like almost alleviating, you know, legal's role as that kind of gate. I've totally veered from your question.
No,
I'm sorry.
But yes,
I guess is this the idea of like, you know, yes, there's different kind of things in the legal tech space, but I feel like, you know, especially students jumping into it, I wouldn't even think of it as legal tech, right? I just think of it as kind of like, what's just a big issue, right? And for us, it's like, why would we graduate and spend our first 3 years copy-pasting indemnification clauses when we know that can be automated? Like, we literally just, it's 2016. Like, you know, like, we know it can be, you know? And so, like...
Exactly, and still, it continues.
Exactly.
Now, looking at all of this, actually, you filled in a gap that you said just before you realized, like, why are we even doing this still? We have to find a solution for this. Are there any particular things in the legal industry or particular practices that you feel are really screaming for a solution still?
That's really interesting. I think that, I mean, because there's a couple things I would say, but we're like about to release things to solve those, so I don't want to kind of fill in those too much. But I guess I'll probably then kind of focus on the litigation side a little bit. I think that there's been a lot of good work in kind of aggregating data from actually, let me even take maybe one more step back. I think a place is kind of variance in judging. I think there's a high level in variance in judging, where judges are given basically the same facts, but come to different conclusions and outcomes. And there's kind of a wariness to leverage statistical analysis to analyze that bias and try to kind of, you know, determine ways to make outcomes more fair. because there's an idea that almost that human bias is what makes it kind of natural and almost what makes it fair and almost a cold calculating, you know, aggressiveness against, which I think doesn't make sense because the whole idea is like, anyway. So I think that's something that's probably screaming for one, but there's probably going to be a lot of social and cultural innovations that would need to happen beforehand.
Yeah, for sure. I think so too. And this is also a topic that I think that it has gained a lot of attention. Now, I was also wondering, you just before you mentioned the investment rounds that you, through Evisort, you went through. What does the investment landscape look like in terms of the investments that are available for legal tech startups?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now is like the hottest it's really ever been. It's honestly really interesting. Like, when we started, and then like we were starting right when the, like pessimism was on the tides of legal tech, and you know VCs were like, "Oh, lawyers won't buy tech," like yada yada, you know, they don't innovate. But recently, it's become very, very hot. I think that people are realizing, which just seems so simple, and honestly, people don't even all know it yet. But like the entire economy is moving to data, and the most important data any company has is their contracts. And so my thing is, like, if you're not turning your contracts into data, what are you doing? Like, why are you going through so much manual effort to turn pieces of your, because all this other data really stems ultimately a lot of times from those documents, and it's from this manual work. And if you would just passively turn your contracts into data up front, you'd solve a lot of legal issues. Now, what I think is weird is that, and I mean, just to answer your question on the VCs, yes, I think it's a really good time for VCs and legal tech. I think everyone is kind of opening their eyes to it. What I'm giving you right now is kind of what I think is kind of underlying it, which is I think that there's a general consensus that there's like a lot more that I think that there's a lot more that probably a lot of legal teams could be providing to the company from a value perspective now that the technology exists to turn contracts, you know, into data. And I feel like that's kind of what's stemming all this. And it's from a workflow perspective too. You know, people want to, you know, drive business. But I do think kind of the push towards data at a macro level is kind of part of what's up. Because just everyone knows that, you know, you want to go to places where there isn't data, where there isn't information. And those are kind of places where you can unlock stuff.
Talking about this whole investment scene, because obviously the episode is focused on law students and entrepreneurship within the legal tech sphere among them. How do you believe that the fact that you guys were students when you started up Evisort impacted the investment opportunities that you came across?
I mean, honestly, I'm not sure how much it impacted the investment opportunities, and that if all things equal, we were students or we weren't students. Frankly, if the counterfactual is that we had other jobs instead of being students, right? You know, assuming the counterfactual isn't that we were just focused only on Evisort, instead we're kind of like balancing it with another job, it's probably better to be in a position of being a student than kind of having a full-time job. On the other end, I'd say where it really helped, like the real value of being students, and I think this is answering your question in that obviously it being a student helping in this other way is going to help us with the VCs because it's kind of, you know, something's going to keep us kind of cohesion. But I think there's less pressure. There's way less pressure. And I feel like a lot of being in a startup is kind of, you know, the hardest part, I think, of being in a startup is that you're spending years doing something that no value is being shown, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And to the whole world, they're just banging your head against the wall. Everyone's like, what are you doing, right? And that constant pressure of what do you do? It's like, oh, I'm in a startup. We've been doing this for like a year and a half. We don't have any clients. You know what I mean? Like, you just have to keep saying that. And you just go crazy after a while. Like, what am I doing? Like, why am I showing up to the same place every day and we're going nowhere, right?
Mm-hmm. And I guess as a student, like, the story is different.
Exactly. They ask you what you're doing. You say, I'm a student at Harvard Law. And they say, congratulations. And well, that's the whole conversation. You know what I mean? They just know that, oh my God. And then when you say you're doing a startup too, it's like, oh wow. Like, you know what I mean? There's no like pressure, just like it's crazy that you're even attempting that, right? And I do think that kind of mindset and that just kind of level of pressure, obviously over a couple of days, no, but over like years, I think definitely kind of changes the mindset. And I also think when you're doing VC funding, you know, if this is it And everyone you know knows that you're talking to this VC this day. Because, like, when they've been asking, that's even, you know, like, it's a lot more pressure versus, like, hey, you know, we're shopping around VCs, you know, we can, you know, we're young, you know, like, it's, I saw, like, yeah, I don't think there's any direct benefit to being a student, but I do think that you're in a kind of different of a mindset as a student founder, which is, I totally think being a student is the time to, even if you're going to, like, it's going to fail, right? I think it's the time to just start something, right? Because I do think that, obviously, of course, you know, grades in school, and there's lots of reasons not to, but for the reasons I just gave, it is a good idea.
But how do you balance being in law school, doing like a job on the side, and also working on this startup all at once? Like, how do you do that? How would you advise others to actually do that?
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely say you got to know what your priorities and what your kind of goals are from, you know, every piece. And so, you know, I would say, like, well, I'd say one, you got to know, like, why you're going to kind of law school and what you kind of want to do, you know, afterwards. You know, my view was always, and I did work at a law firm, you know, over the summer, worked the ropes and grain, actually had, you know, a really good time there. But what I would say is, like, you know, it was a privilege, and, you know, going to a school like Harvard, there's no, you know, scholarships, right? So you're going to pay a lot of money, but it does allow you to kind of have a more safe options afterwards, even if you kind of did less on the kind of academic side, right? And so I was able to, you know, relax a bit more on the academic side. And I think what was honestly was an interesting case study in is that, like, what if someone's whole law school was focused around legal tech and, like, you know, on analyzing contracts and being able to just that experience of learning how to break down contracts and the component parts? Would they learn enough about the law to, like, just be a lawyer, right? You know, instead of just reading cases for 3 years, would the person who reads cases for 3 years know enough to do the other work, right? And so I do think it's, you know, interesting from a philosophical question from that perspective. But I mean, I just say it was a lot of work. Cause I mean, if you want me to be real with you, it's like, just sleep less, frankly. Like, you know,
best advice.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's, you know, if you want to do, and, like, you know, I was doing, like, lots of stuff with the Afghan Law Association too. And, like, APJ, and I just kind of was like, hey, these are three magical years when I can do things. I can literally meet with presidents. You know, I can literally start a company and, like, you know, go to all these interesting things. And I'm gonna sleep less. You know, and so that was kind of a view I had on it there. And then I'd also say, I mean, I didn't. You know, law school is also interesting in that I do think I didn't go to all my classes in law school, and so, like, I think is what's interesting is that, you know, I really like the law school thing, but I feel like they don't evaluate you in law school based off the effort you put into class, in that you will have all these classes where you're just going so deep into one case, and you know that person's first kid and, like, their name and their birthday, and, you know, everything about that guy in that case. When it comes to the exam, they'll just be like, what case talked about this? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, at a high level, you know, and, like, being good in class, like, you will learn so much extra stuff that, like, for that one point of evaluation that you have for that entire 4 months, that level of detail is not necessary, right? And so, like, I think you can actually get lost in class. The thing that's important is on the outline that's been the same for their exams the last 5 years. Right? Those are the, you know, and, like, you know, you can go and talk and have these asides, right? But if it comes to the Just remember, I'm not saying don't go to class, right? But I'm just saying, even if you do go to class, like, remember that, like, you know, the exam does not perfectly replicate kind of, like, every conversation you're having in class.
I love this advice. So sleep less and don't go to class. No, I'm kidding. No, but I totally understand it. And it's really impressive, to be honest. I think it definitely is a challenge, and you definitely need to know where you're going when you choose to do something like this. Now, maybe looking into the practical side of actually starting up a legal tech startup, and then from your perspective in law school. So first of all, of course, you work at Evisort. That's the startup we're talking about. So can you maybe first tell us a tiny little bit more about what exactly Evisort does?
Yeah, most definitely. So we're contract intelligence and a CLM, contract lifecycle management company. Basically, what we started off as was a contract management system, so you can upload documents to the system. You know, traditionally, if you want to keep track of an expiration date, you upload the contract and you type the expiration date that you just typed in the contract before, and then it will remind you before the expiration date because you typed that in, right? But if you forget to write the expiration date, then it won't do it. And if you forget to say, hey, this is an NDA, when you later say, show me all my NDAs, it won't show up, right? Even though it's an NDA. And so what we basically said was, that's not contract management, because you're the one managing the contract, right? Just through your system. If you forget to type it, it's not. So like, who's managing the contract? Not the system. What we said is, let's make an actual contract management system where all you need is the document. And once you have the document, you have the information, because the information's in the document and it's 2020. So like, why would you have to write it again? Like, it didn't make sense. And so basically, when you upload any contract, it can be scanned PDF, anything, the Eversort, we automatically pull out 60 data points, right? And we work, you know, which is very kind of was our innovation in the field, which is that, like, on our demos, we don't just say, hey, here's a document we've uploaded 10 times today, you know, watch it work. We say, send us any contract you want right now. And then we upload it. And then in 6 seconds, they'll see the results. And if they didn't, then why are they talking to us, right? Like, why? You need to, we want to change the culture and basically say, if it doesn't work on day zero, it's not going to work on day one. And so many people have bad stories with AI, but they're not really changing how they're evaluating AI. They're just kind of closing up to AI. But the reason that didn't work is because the AI doesn't work. And the only thing you do when you buy a tool is you'll just receive contracts you've never seen before from vendors and counterparties, and you'll upload them to the tool and expect results. And if when you're evaluating a tool, if you're not just uploading contracts it's never seen before and seeing its results in seconds, then you're going to end up holding the bag because you weren't testing for the thing you're actually doing with it, right? If you're testing it only on documents that the vendor provides, then I hope you're only doing contracts with that vendor, right? But if not, then, you know, it's and so that's kind of what we do at our core, right? Now, we last year actually came out with full end-to-end contract management. So we do the pre-signature, you know, intake forms, directing workflows, doing approval workflows, all the way through e-signature where we sync with Adobe Sign and DocuSign. And so from that moment that a salesperson or business person on your team wants to kind of make a request to generate a contract, all the way through managing the obligations and expirations, et cetera, kind of years after, we're kind of that full end-to-end system using AI every step.
Yeah, so really from start to finish and even beyond that. But as you said, like, so the AI is really the fundamental part of the company that really, you know, you need to have that right before you can actually look at the rest. Is that what you're...
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, we were frustrated that this didn't already exist. And so, and then when we made it, we were surprised that other people didn't really have it. And then we kind of thought a lot of folks did, but then when we learned about kind of people's experiences actually kind of setting up those systems where a lot of times you kind of have to train the AI on your documents afterwards, you know, that's not a good experience to purchase a product and then build it, right? It's like, why did I purchase it? I have to kind of build it afterwards. And so, you know, I think being contract type agnostic and actually being able to provide that day one value on 60 data points. Yes, you can train your own, but like, you're getting a lot out of the box. And the thing is, you'd have to be a psychopath to ask your paralegal to track 60 things in your contract. You know what I mean? Like, if you were asking your paralegal to copy paste every force majeure before 2019, like, that might be against human rights, right? Like that. But obviously you needed that in 2020, right? And so like, there's always going to be something that you're not tracking. Getting too much data from your contracts is not a problem. Because like I said, legal doesn't see it because they're not the ones who needs all that value. They're not the one, you know what I mean? But the other business units, and that's kind of the line we're trying to connect. Like, we just want to get that data there so legal's not always being asked these questions. The other people just have it.
What did the startup phase generally look like? And what are some of the lessons learned from this process or advice that you could give to others thinking of starting up?
Well, I'd say a couple things. I'd say one, like, definitely follow your gut, and definitely everyone's way smarter than they think because the internet exists, you know? So you kind of actually know what's happening in the world better than you think you do. Like, we all do, you know? Like, and so if there's something where you're just like, it's ridiculous that this doesn't exist, it probably is, you know? And there's something where you just think, like, plainly. And I think when you do that, you'll see the world catch up to you, you know? And so like, and I think that's what you don't want to do is like say, oh my God, this is happening right now. Let me jump on this, right? What you want to do is like, this is a gap no one's seeing. Let me work on this. And then in a year or two, when people start seeing it, we'll be well positioned, right? And so like, you've got to like trust yourself a little bit, right? To actually kind of, you know, go that extra step and kind of trust that you're seeing something that, but I think you'll be right if you do. I'd also say like, I mean, your founding team, you know, is very, very important. Even from a VC perspective, VCs don't know anything about kind of any technology, right? They just know about money, right? And so like, they are not going to be like, you know, analyzing your code. They're going to be sizing you up and kind of saying, is this a team that can, you know, go far? And frankly, a lot of success is going to be less on the idea and more of the team. You know, if you get a good team working on a bad idea, you know, it's better than a bad team working on a good idea, right? And so our team's really close friends. I mean, it's because we, you know, we're students together for kind of 3 years first, right? But like, you know, all the founding team is still kind of here, and like, we're going to each other's weddings. I'm the best man at one with Morocco for Amin's wedding, who's our CTO, you know. So just, you know, I think that kind of level is also good. Harder with COVID, of course, but you know.
Definitely. Oh, that's really amazing. Speaking of COVID, how have you tackled the challenge of COVID with such a big team now at Evisort?
It's interesting. I mean, COVID has affected us uniquely in that going into COVID, we were like probably 60% smaller than we are now. I mean, we've more than doubled during COVID. So we raised our Series A of $15 million in like end of November 2019. And so March 2020, we were going to move to a bigger office in Silicon Valley, and we were supposed to open up an office in Toronto and New York. And we had the leases for all three. But of course, we didn't sign them because it was March 2020 and, you know, the world was shutting down, right? And that was also supposed to be the year that we were able to go out and say, hey, we're Evisort, go to all the conferences, you know, use that, spend that 15 mil, right? But we couldn't. And then this March, we raise another 35 mil. So now we've raised 50 million, but we're still in our like seed-sized office and like have, you know, very low awareness. And so like, we're trying to go to conferences, trying to get our name out, trying to kind of do more, you know, do more of that. But I'd say it affected us, one, in that kind of, it was that growth skill. And two, like I said, more than half the company has been hired during COVID. They have over 130 in the US and Canada now. And so, you know, a lot of people haven't met each other, right? And we've been able to have one summit in person in that kind of twilight when it looked like things were opening back up. But then, you know, of course, Delta has come back. And so all the other future kind of ones have been, summits have been canceled, right? And so I just think we've got folks in 14 states now. We have to be a remote company now. We don't really have a choice. And then, frankly, it's been working. We've been scaling and doing very well. But, you know, it's just, it's definitely had an effect.
Now, to wrap up this episode, looking towards the future, where do you see Evisort heading? And also in terms of your own future plans, what have you got in mind?
Yeah, I mean, we want to continue to push the envelope of AI and law, but in a way that works day one, right? And isn't like, hey, we have this thing and then you buy it and then you kind of spend months kind of training it, right? And so I think what we're looking at next from an AI perspective is, I already told you how we kind of started with AI post-SIG, right? Then we kind of built out the, you know, UI, the actual technology for post-SIG. And now we've kind of did the UI into actual technology for pre-signature, all those approvals. And what we're looking to do now, we already have AI in pre-SIG, but we really want to make it more robust, more no code, right? Where when we talk about, hey, I want to have AI review my contract at a first pass. Like, when we do that for folks now, it's kind of a whole build, right? Where we have to take your playbook and kind of, you know, build it out for you and kind of, you know, give it to you. And then kind of as changes are necessary, we'll kind of help out there, right? But we want almost to be able to make AI so simple that you can self-serve the development of your own playbook, but make it so easy and no code that a lawyer could do it. So a lawyer could sit down, kind of take their playbook and then kind of build it out and then automate it. So then if contracts come through, you know, when there's particular language that, you know, breaches the essence of it, it's not just direct language, right? But just like the essence and the actual kind of thoughts that are kind of being breached, right? Like, oh no, term length needs to be above this or lower than this, right? Or, you know, indemnification needs to be both ways or something like that. Then of course, flagging it and, you know, providing the, and providing the fallback language, right? But we want to make it super simple. So one, we want the AI to be able to work day one for folks. But then two, because these playbooks change a lot, especially with these global companies, you know, there's got to be a lot of flexibility. We just want to also make sure it's self-serve enough and kind of ready to go. And so, I mean, our vision is still the same of kind of AI every step of the way, but also robust and kind of, you know, clean. And we didn't talk about this also, but we're also deep on APIs, in which, like I said, we think this data is important for every other team too. So we want to make sure we can be that single source of truth, pushing data to other systems. We want them to keep using Salesforce, you know, Ariba. There's a reason sales uses Salesforce and procurement uses Ariba and these other teams use these other systems, right? But, you know, there's not a reason that they should all be typing the same information from contracts when, you know, you can have the contracts in one place, generate that data and push it to all of them.
Yeah. No, really interesting. So definitely some plans that you guys are working on. And of course, I take it that you're staying, of course, that ever sought to work on this in the longer term.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Now, I know that you're in a bit of a rush, so I think we'll leave it at this. And I really want to thank you for the time that you gave to chat about this. I think it was really, really interesting. And I hope that the listeners will also, of course, get some good insights from this. So thank you. Thank you very much.
No worries. And thanks for your excellent question. It was a joy speaking.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow the Law of Tech on social media. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast.